Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Before I get to my guest, who is really going to be informative about one of the more important figures in all of psychiatry who has recently passed. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. I'm getting my web page straightened out so you can finally see where I'm going to be from time to time. And on October 2nd, I haven't announced this before, but it's coming up soon, I'm going to be speaking in Utica, New York. Anybody around Utica? October 2nd. It's going to be a significant presentation, not just an hour, and it's called Rethinking Mental Health. And it's me and Robert Whitaker. If you want a 1-2 punch of information, there is no better 1-2 punch on the face of the earth than Peter Bregan and Robert Whitaker. Whitaker, of course, the author of the best-selling Anatomy of an Epidemic about just how bad psychiatric drugs are affecting us. And we're going to share the day. So, I mean, it's going to be really a spectacular day for folks who can make it to Utica, New York. And you can find it on my website. You go to Bregan.com and hit upcoming, well, it's on the left-hand side of the page, and just hit what you see there in terms of public events and public speaking. And that'll take you to the page. And on October 2nd, my radio show is going to have on Michael Guy Thompson, who spent 4 years working with R.D. Lang. So for those of you who don't know Lang, look him up, L-A-I-N-G. You should know him. He's one of the two or three real innovators in the field of psychiatry in the last, the history of psychiatry, I would say. Today, my guest... Oh, by the way, I need to make a reference to these terrible shootings. I've been doing a lot of media on the shootings in D.C., and I'm going to be doing more. I'm not going to spend time on my show doing that, since I'm going to be doing so much out there in the world. But I want to point out one of the most important pieces of information that is being missed, and that is Alexis, who went in and shot up the U.S. Naval Building Center there down in D.C., huge facility, and killed a number of people, wounded another of people. There's a lot of interesting things about him. But in terms of our work, Alexis apparently had never had psychiatric treatment until the month before the shootings. In August, he told the Newport, Rhode Island police that he was hearing voices and being abused through walls wherever he went in the hotels. And they told the Navy about it. And he ended up going to the VA in that area. And then he went to the VA down in D.C. And inside sources are quoted as saying that he was treated for sleep problems, but also for a psychosis. At least one friend has said he was on medication. And the media, of course, is just staying totally away from this. I mean, I watched a lot of television on this with my wife last night. Nothing. So we've got one more example that most of the shooters, the vast majority of the shooters, have been involved with psychiatry. Many, many of them have been put on psychiatric drugs. In this case, the first contact fits into what we know happens, which is that you have a contact within a month or two, first start on psychiatric drugs, it's the most likely time you're going to get worse because of the drugs. This needs the attention of folks. And that's about all I'm going to say about that tragedy. A heart goes out to the victims. Psychiatry needs to look at itself about doing more harm than good. It gets a look at so many of the people who commit these kinds of violence. It does nothing to properly evaluate them. And, of course, the treatments it offers them are worse than nothing. Worse than nothing. Because they further humiliate these people. They tell them they're mental patients. They tell them they need drugs. They compromise their thinking, their ability to control themselves by giving them psychoactive substances and impair their frontal lobes. They don't give them the help they need. And that brings me to my guest, Robert E. Wubeling. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. I'm right here.
Bob, give me a good pronunciation of your last name.
Okay, the accent's on the first syllable, Wubelding.
Wubelding.
Yes.
It's not like Bob is a complete stranger to me. We have met in the past, but we haven't been good friends, but I could easily imagine it. Bob's last name is spelled Wubbolding.
And in Anglo, old Anglo-Saxon, it means Wilbert's court.
Oh, how interesting. Wubelding. Robert E. Wolf. You can easily find him on the net. He has been a leader in the reality therapy field for a long, long time. I don't think he's as old as I am, but he's definitely been around for a while. I think that's fair to say. How old are you?
Well, I'm 77 years old.
Oh, my God.
And when I taught at Xavier University, my students, when they got to know me a little bit, the graduate students would come up and ask me, they'd say, we were talking and we're wondering how old you are. And then I'd say, how old do you think I am? And then whatever they'd say, I'd say, well, that's about right.
Well, as some of my listeners know, I'm 77 years old. What's your birthday?
February 11th.
Oh, you're a little older than me, you poor fella. May 11th.
May 11th. Okay.
Well, Bob is, and is that the best way to call you?
Yes, Bob, please.
Bob and Peter here.
Okay.
Bob is very heavily involved in reality therapy, which was the creation of Bill Glasser. He teaches reality therapy. He has run a reality therapy center. He's done a lot of books on reality therapy, done a lot of articles on reality therapy. Some of his books are Reality Therapy for the 21st Century, and another is Employee Motivation and a Set of Directions for Putting and Keeping Yourself Together. Bill Glasser, who Bob knows, knew really, really well. When did Bill die? It's really not long.
He died August 23rd this year.
August 20th. Yeah. Bill had been sick for a long time. I've known Bill Glasser for many years, and I read his book, Reality Therapy, is one of his earliest books decades ago. It had a very, very positive influence on me. He's certainly one of the people who influenced me in a positive way. I think I helped inform him on the psychiatric drug issues in a positive way. He invited me to speak at one of his big conferences in Canada. I invited him to speak at a couple of mine. And whenever I needed anything, a new advisory council member for my new organization, a good quote about one of my books or my work, Bill was always just right there to, even in recent years when he was not well, to lend a hand. Today, I'm looking forward to hearing a lot more about Bill Glasser and reality therapy. but I'm also interested in learning more about Robert Wobelding and his work. So, Bob, where do you want to begin?
Well, anyway, first, Peter, thank you for the opportunity to be on your show. This is a very high honor to be mentioned in the same breath as Peter Breggin. I know of your work. I've read some of your books, and they are quite controversial, which I think you enjoy, and as did Glasser, enjoy the controversies that he was able to create, because this is a day and age when there's a lot of thinking and customs, I think, that need to be exposed. But let me start with a little story about Dr. Glasser, and I'd like to just say something that happened right toward the end of his life. This was within weeks of his death. A young woman came to him in his home and wanted his advice about her young child. And she said, you know, my child is starting to act out in kind of ways, slapping and so on. He was about 3 or 4 years old. And she said, what can I do about this? And Glasser paused for a long time. And I think he reached down deep inside of him through all of his pain and his suffering at that time. And he said two things to her. He said, always treat your children as if they are good. And secondly, set them up for in situations where they can only succeed. And I just thought that's a pretty good closure to his life, that this is the kind of way he looked at the world. And, of course, you can make a lot of distinctions, which he didn't do at that time, but at the same time, he was trying to say to treat your kids in this way, and then when they grow up, they really won't need all the antisocial behavior and the mind-altering drugs and so on, because they will have success in their lives, and they will have good interpersonal relationships, which he believed was at the root of the antisocial acting out, harmful behaviors, and all the diagnoses that we have for people. He believed and taught that at the root is dysfunctional relationships. And when you improve those relationships, everything improves. It may not get better 100%, but it improves. So I thought that story was very typical of his life, really.
Well, that's interesting. I had expected something tougher, because I think of Bill, and I think of his choice theory and his idea that you confront people with the fact that they're responsible for themselves and they make their own choices, and that's the key to life. But the story you're telling is so much softer and supportive than that.
I think that's the way he became over the years, and because he developed it in tough situations, in a mental hospital and a correctional institution. And I think in the early years, people associated reality therapy with consequences and confrontation. And,
confrontation, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But that can be part of it. It just depends how it's done. But as time went on, I think especially the people that followed him kind of combined the importance of empathy and positive regard, not only having it, but demonstrating it in an accurate way to clients and to students in school and so on. So
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the whole world of therapy, the people who have some wisdom and experience, is really moving more and more toward emphasizing caring, empathic relationship as the heart of what we have to offer. I'm seeing that, you know, more and more. Just a few years ago when Ginger and I decided on the name Empathic Therapy, mm-hmm. or our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, we made this huge decision to move away from something like critical psychiatry or
yes.
something with a hard edge to it, to talk about what folks really need. I'm hearing that, and I'm so glad to hear that Bill was talking that way, and I'm so glad to hear you talking that way.
Well, I think the motivational interviewing people say that the one thing that makes a difference, the one thing that makes a difference and helps people to change most effectively is, do they feel understood? And in other words, does the counselor, the therapist, the teacher, the parent, the helper really understand them? And that's what I like about reality therapy, is it provides a system for understanding the person. It provides a structure for what to listen for. And so that really facilitates the change, probably more than, pushing the person and confronting them.
Yeah. And the calming influence you described, Bill, as coming forth with a really calming set of ideas.
I think the more upset the person is, the calmer the therapist and counselor has to be.
Yes, I couldn't have said that better. I'll tell you something very touching. For me, I took a little boy, one of my patients, who's got huge behavioral problems, and I take him for a walk each time he comes in, which is not very frequent. He comes from far away, and we took a walk and came back. And as I came back to his mom and his dad and getting ready to go, and there was a painter standing in the hallway, older gentleman who needed to come in and get paid by my wife for some work, and apparently things had gotten closed up, and he couldn't get her attention, and I sort of, handled the situation and brought him into the back of the room and said goodbye to my patient and his family, thinking, wow, this is utter chaos. And we walked in and said, I introduced myself and introduced him to my wife, and he turns to my wife and he says, he'd never met me before, he said, your husband has this calming influence. He said, I guess that's the work you do. And he said, I don't think you can teach that. I don't usually boast on the show, but it was really, really touching. And it shows how quickly people sense where you're coming from with them.
I often say that the work of any helper, really, but especially the reality therapist, is to comfort the afflicted, but then sometimes to afflict the comfortable, and in the sense that when somebody is too comfortable in their problem, like the alcoholic person who doesn't see any problem, we don't need to be nasty with them, because support also is very effective, probably more effective than hammering on the person. But we want to help them, as we say in choice theory and reality therapy, is help them get their mental scale out of balance a little bit, that things are not going so well with them. And we kind of create a situation where they're motivated to do something about their problems. So it's a kind of a twofold thing. But whenever we talk about confrontation or helping people be a little bit afflicted with their problem when they're overly complacent, I think that's easily misunderstood to be where we're kind of nasty about it, and that's not really the. That's not really the work of the reality therapist.
Oh, I'm just really delighted with the way you're talking about this. Tell folks, what's unique about reality therapy? Go ahead.
One of the things that I teach is that there are similarities among all these systems, as you said, that they seem to be coming together in many ways. So there is a common ground. There's no question about that. But one of the helpful, I think, tools is to help people self-evaluate. I haven't seen that in other systems quite as much. At least it hasn't received the emphasis that it does in reality therapy, which is helping people evaluate their own behavior. In fact, in the book Reality Therapy for the 21st Century, I formulated 22 kinds of self-evaluation, where we ask the person to make a judgment on their own behavior. For example, is what you're doing getting you what you want? And let me illustrate that. Some time ago, I was counseling a young woman who wanted to move out of her one parent's home in with her other parent, and she was doing all kinds of things that had the reverse effect. She was, you know, staying out late, not doing chores and skipping school. And I just said to her very calmly, I said, well, is what you're doing going to get you what you want, which is to move out? And her quote was, and I remember it so vividly, she said, I never thought of it that way. She never connected her behavior with what she wanted. To the helper, this is, you know, not all that complicated, but that's why we're the helpers. And so she was able to evaluate and connect what she wanted with what she was doing. So that's I think, a crucial point. It's really the keystone in the arch. It's what holds the whole system together. We help people define what they want, examine what they're doing, and then evaluate it. And also to evaluate the attainability of what they want. Is what you want realistic? Like the 15-year-old who wants to be left alone. How realistic is that? And Bill Gates one time gave a talk to some high school kids, and he said, if you think your teacher's mean, wait till you get a boss. So not everybody's nice to people. And but is it possible to be left alone? And we can try to, you know, we do that. A lot of our communication is in our tone of voice. It's in our behavior. It's in our attitude, which people can pick up pretty well as to whether we have a sense of compassion for them. So those are some of the kinds of self-evaluation. You want to hear a third kind?
I do. I think that the concept of self-evaluation is a really good one. I'd like to hear more about it.
The one that I really like and that I tried myself actually to develop is an evaluation of their perception, which is where they see their control. Do they see it inside or do they see it outside? And so we kind of challenge people a little bit who feel totally victimized by their past or by society. And we ask them, is it really true that you have no choices? And I'll often tell them the story of Viktor Frankl, who had very little choice during the Second World War about his actions, but he did have a choice about how he would perceive this diabolic world in which he had to live. But so there's always a choice, which of course is easy to say, but many people don't feel that way. And so we try to say, is it true that you have no choices? And, you know, if you were to make a different choice today, what would it be? So, you know, so the tendency is to help people deal with that sense of victimhood. Now, the danger of that thinking is people, I've heard this said, oh, you're blaming the victim. Well, that's exact opposite of what we're doing. We're empowering the victim to make a choice to satisfy those motivators inside of him or her.
Well, I think that is so important. You know, the case of the shooter, Alexis, or the D.C. shooter, the latest D.C. shooter, where he is hallucinating that other people are persecuting him, is carrying to the extremes the notion of being a victim. And it results in him being terrorized. It's not like he ends up saying, oh, this is good, I'm a victim.
Yeah.
He becomes such a victim over the years. And clearly he thinks he's a victim on many occasions. He strikes back. He hurts other people. He fires guns and scares people. And in this case, he ends up being a total victim, calling the police. He's so out of it to protect him from the people who are harassing him through the walls. And in the walls and getting to his body with the magnetic waves. And that isn't crazy in the sense it requires an explanation other than an ordinary human one, which is he got pushed into the, and pushed himself by a series of terrible choices into the ultimate victim place. And victims often become perpetrators because they get tired of being victims and they strike back. So it's a very destructive cycle. And so important. I so agree with you, Bob, about the importance of people not allowing themselves to become either helpless or victimized, which is a kind of helplessness. The beginning of getting better emotionally, of feeling better about yourself, and of having more control is clearly that key point of deciding to choose to take charge of your life. And nobody put it as well or as early as Bill Glasser. Could we switch just a little bit? I think we can just go in and out of the subject of you, Bill Glasser, me a little bit, and so on. How did Bill get started? Do you know? And what did he run into when he started saying, it's not an illness, it's choice? When did he begin that, and did anybody influence him?
Well, I think, yes, he was influenced. I think a man named Helmut Kaiser was one of the influences in his life, and who said that the goal of the analyst is to, as he said, make people responsible for their behavior. And then another major influence was a man named Dr. Harrington. Even in his later years, Glasser referred to him as my teacher. He was his supervisor at the VA hospital in Los Angeles. And one time Glasser came to him and said, you know, he said, I see the other, this is when Glasser was an intern. I see these other psychiatrists talking about the reality issues that people have and holding them responsible. And he says, I would like to function that way. And I'd like to develop a therapy like that based on what you taught me. And Harrington reached across the desk and said, the famous quote, join the club. And from that time on, they developed together the early principles of reality therapy.
And, what year is that, Bob?
That would be, well, his first book was 1964. It was called Mental Health or Mental Illness. But the one that really made his reputation was called Reality Therapy in 1965.
And, see, we have Bill Glasser beginning to publish then. We have Thomas Zoss beginning to publish his good stuff then. Mm-hmm. We have R.D. Lang beginning to publish his good stuff, all three psychiatrists, and probably the only period of time in history when you had three psychiatrists saying interesting and important things.
Yeah.
It was a remarkable coming together at that moment in time of people who didn't know each other, didn't much agree with each other about a lot of things,
right?
But who were all thinking creatively during that time. It's such an interesting period. And I was at that point, I was just entering my residency in 62, but I've been thinking about these things since, you know, 18 was 1954.
Oh, yeah.
But I just had these good influences to pull on.
Yeah, it's interesting that at that time, those geniuses came not together, but they came out and were teaching this. It kind of reminds me of the founders of this country that you've written about so eloquently in your book, Wow, I'm an American. I think everybody ought to read that book, especially college students. I was looking at it again last night, and it's a marvelous book describe, you know, the glories of the United States and the opportunities and so on. And at that time of the founding of this country, these geniuses came together. They didn't agree on a lot of things either. But this was perhaps also a time in the mental health profession where these individuals developed their ideas fairly independently of each other, but at the same time they developed a kind of a rebellion against the current mental health system that was widespread at that time. And Glasser said, let's deal with the choices people have and let's help them make better choices. And
what kind of trouble did he run into?
He was not accepted at all in the field. He began to give lectures after he published the book Reality Therapy, but he called it Reality Psychiatry at first. But then when he went to give public lectures, psychiatrists didn't show up. And so the people that showed up were counselors and social workers and educators and corrections people and psychologists. So he very quickly changed the name to Reality Therapy And because of so many educators coming to hear him, he developed a program called Schools Without Failure and wrote that in a book in 1968, and then developed that idea even further in the 90s with what is called the Glasser Quality School. So he really developed it along with, you know, some other people who helped him and
fostered. How did he apply these ideas to the Glasser Quality School?
What was that? I didn't hear you.
How did he apply these ideas to the Glasser Quality School?
Well, the Quality School is a program where the teachers learn the theoretical basis called choice theory and the delivery system in schools called LEAD management. It's really reality therapy, but we don't want to imply that teachers are therapists. But the where we really work on the five needs that human beings have, according to the choice theory, the need for survival, especially the need for belonging.
Hey, Bob, let's hold on the five needs, because I've been so interested in talking to you, I've let us run over.
Oh.
We're talking to Dr. Robert E. Wubbolding, W-U-B-B-O-L-D-I-N-G, who's worked very closely with William Glasser over the years, the author of Reality Therapy. When we're going to come back, he's going to talk some about schools and applying these principles to schools, because good principles of life should apply to every institution, whether it's a church or a school, maybe even the army, maybe. These principles should apply. So we'll go to the music and come back again in a few minutes. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. Golly, I hope the folks listening in to this show, as well as to a number of our recent shows, have a sense of the treasure that they're having, which is to hear from these pioneers in the field and hear them talk about, in some cases, their mentors who were giants in the field. I don't know anywhere else where you're going to get this education. You actually can't get it almost anywhere, getting a PhD in psychology or a master's or PhD in social work or counseling. You might hear a little bit of what you hear on this show. But this show is becoming the place where you can learn about what really is meaningful in the field of mental health. And it's a pleasure, Bob, to have you on the show with me today.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Well, you were going to talk about how these Glasser principles, the reality therapy principles, got applied to schools. Then I'd also like you to talk at some point about how did he apply these principles to profoundly disturbed people, the folks who get drugged up and called schizophrenic and bipolar and so on.
Okay, well, how do they apply to schools? I think we have to go back to the basic theory, where we try to incorporate the needs, the human needs. As I said, one of them is survival, although we don't deal with that a whole lot in education, but to some extent we do. But especially belonging, and if we can create that kind of atmosphere in a school where kids feel that they belong there, and they feel connected with the teacher, and they feel connected with each other without being criticized and argued with, etc., things can improve. And another need is a need for power or a sense of inner control, a sense of self-regulation. A third psychological need, fourth need overall, is the need for freedom or to make choices. And then the need for fun. So if you ask an elementary school child, what is a good teacher, they'll say, the teacher makes learning fun. And so if we can, you know, incorporate those ideas, especially into the into the curriculum, into the atmosphere of the school, the quality of the school increases, and what we found is that the achievement increases and the behavioral problems decrease. And then, of course, to teach the teachers and the educators, the whole building, everybody from the cafeteria workers to the maintenance people to the administration, to teach them how to talk to kids using really the principles of reality therapy, and to talk to kids and help the children self-evaluate their behavior and self-evaluate their work. And what we find is that behavior is that they're tougher sometimes on themselves than a teacher would be when they self-evaluate. So the program, I don't say the program's caught on with 1,000 schools that we wish it had, but it's a long process, and the schools around the country are listed on Glasser's website, and there's only about 20-some schools. One is in Slovenia, one is in Australia, one is in Ireland, the rest are in the United States. But it is a program where people can learn this and practice it, both in their own lives and apply it to each other in school. So it's really when they take it seriously and get trained in it, not just be nice. We're not talking about just being nice to people, but, you know, really get trained in talking to people with these concepts in mind, the atmosphere improves. And I'll tell you another thing that happens is there's less turnover among the staff. And I know there's one school in Illinois where I worked. It's a residential school for kids, and one of the people said, one of the administrators told me, he said there's less turnover. He said, but success brings its own problems. He says, because people hear about this place, they come and visit, and then they hire our faculty. So, there is less turnover, but that can happen.
So how do you keep up the training standard for the schools? By the way, I would change your tone about having only 20 schools. I'd say, and we have 20 schools.
Yeah, that's
because someone who's trying to get his ideas implemented in the real world, I'd say having 20 schools in this day and age is a miracle.
Yeah, sometimes I violate my own beliefs and minimize.
So, hey, wow, these 20 schools. How do you keep the training standard up? How do you keep them being consistent with the choice theory?
Well, it ideally it includes ongoing training. And what we do is we try to train the staff of these various schools so that they can conduct the training and make it indigenous instead of having somebody come in from the outside. When they take ownership for their own training and their own work rather than, you know, rely on an external person who comes in with this little black bag, that's much less effective. But they do need that in the beginning. But we have instructors in some of these schools. For example, in Florida, there are some schools there that have their own instructors. And so these are really very good programs. Now, we need more publicity. We need more research on the successes. But they are successful, but... and I've been beating that drum in the Glasser Institute for years about we need controlled studies. We have research, but we need better research and we need more studies. So that's just one of our issues that we contend with over the years.
I'm going to be down giving talks in Tampa a couple of times in the coming year. Is there a school near Tampa I could visit?
No, they're on the East Coast.
Okay.
In the Brevard County.
That's not a surprise.
Yeah.
There
is one. Wait a minute. Tropic Isles Elementary School, which is in Fort Myers.
Okay.
That's an excellent. And they have very good data, and they're in the process of writing an article on that, on their research.
Now, people can find out about these schools by going where on the internet?
To go to the Glasser website, which is wglasser.com.
www.glasser.com. See, Bill, being even older than me, was able to get simple websites like Bregan.com.
Yeah.
He had to go to wglasser.com. what about working with people who are labeled psychotic, people who are very, very disturbed? Do you do that, and did Bill do that?
Well, Glasser, he actually started it with extremely disturbed people. And so it is a kind of a rational system, but people will ask me, how does this rational system apply to people who are not so rational? And the way Glasser did it and the way we all do it is to talk to the part of the person that is healthy, the part of the person that is sane, or whatever words we want to use, and try to increase that, because we would talk a lot about what they're doing when they're not hearing voices and when they're not getting in trouble. Same way with any kind of disturbance or any kind of ineffective behavior, whether it's drug dependence or acting out antisocially, whatever it may be, we would certainly acknowledge that and talk about it, but not emphasize it as if that is the problem. The problem is that they're generating these behaviors because of something lacking inside, which is the effective need satisfaction. So I can recall talking to a woman who heard voices, and it was not a real serious case, but she heard these voices, and we start talking, and she said, "Do you want to hear about my voices?" And I said, "Well, as long as they're not, I don't need to hear about it in detail, as long as they're not telling you to do something harmful." And so we start talking about the reality issues, how she lived her life, her relationships, which she had very few of. And so I tried to steer her toward that and help doing things that healthy people do. And her voice has gradually vanished. It may take a lot longer time with more serious disturbance, but that's an example of not seeing the, whether it's a phobia or a compulsion or a psychosis or whatever it may be, seeing that as the problem. That's the symptom for the problem. That's the behavior. And that's why Glasser stresses towards the end of his life, and for many years, really, he stressed that this is a mental health system, not a mental disturbance system. And so that sounds so simple until you really dig into it. And when I do demonstrations in my own workshops, once in a while somebody said, "Well, yeah, but you didn't deal with that person's psychosis. You didn't deal with their depression." And I say, that's exactly what I did deal with it. I did deal with that because I'm dealing with an alternative to that. I used to work at a halfway house for women ex-offenders, and they would say, "We want to tell you our war stories." And I'd say, "You know more about that than I do, and I can help you with an alternative to that, to the drug addiction and the trouble, the prison and so on." And in fact, they used to say, "How can you?" I learned this from Glasser. They used to say, "How can you help me if you've never been in prison?" And I would say, that's exactly why I can help you, because I am an expert at staying out of prison.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. That's right. That's really beautiful. One of the things that I find that the people whom I feel would be helpful human beings like yourself is that we tend to treat everybody the same. We don't have a program for eating disorders and a program for sexual disorders and a program for people who are hallucinating and a program for people who are depressed. We're always trying to find out how we can be helpful in the growth of the person who's come to see us, assuming that if we do that, a lot of other things are going to just go of their own accord.
Yeah. Well, it's a day and age of emphasizing problems rather than solutions.
And of compartmentalizing people.
Yeah,
diagnostically, trying to do it biochemically, which can't be done. Even the diagnostic can't be done. It always says your primary issue is that is how you're failing rather than what can you do to succeed, which is basically similar for all of us, the principles of succeeding.
I had a couple of counseling. I'll never forget the comment that the man made. They had been through many types of counseling over the years, and he made this statement. He said, you know, when all is said and done, somebody's got to do the dishes. And I thought, boy, that really represents a very profound thought. When all is said and done, no matter how much we talk about all the problems and everything, we got to negotiate how we're going to live today. And that's the emphasis that reality therapy takes.
Does it have much of a, I mean, that's hinting at a social nature, that which I am deeply committed to. And to, you know, who's going to do the dishes in a partnership, in a family, is a profound question. And how much do you and Bill, who's now gone, Bill Glasser, how much do y'all emphasize the social quality of being a human being?
Well, yeah, I think that's the need for belonging. And whether it's family belonging or school belonging, work belonging, this is essential. And when people improve their relationships, things improve. For example, if you looked at the DSM, Glasser used to call it the Big Book of Unhappiness. And if you look at all the categories, I think you could say that every one of them has a social aspect. It has a belonging aspect. You know, you just look at them, and there's a relationship dysfunction somewhere in there. And so that's a good place to start. I always tell beginning counselors, when you don't know what to do, start with their relationships. Start with how are you getting along with the people around you. And lo and behold, when you start to get along with them, you can kind of feel a little bit better about your life. Maybe not perfect, but this is a mental health system, so we're going to look at mentally healthy people and do what they do. Like I've always thought, if you, and I got this from Glasser, I want to attribute, of course, to him, the ideas. And if you want to be rich, what do? You look at rich people and do what they do. If you want to be healthy, you look at healthy people and do what they do. So mentally healthy, the same idea. So that's why he stressed the relationships and the accomplishment, the fun, making choices and all of those things that people who are, well, I guess you'd say healthy, things that they do. So it sounds, I've always thought that what Bill taught was something that sounded simple, but when you really look at it, there's a certain underlying subterranean communication that happens when we talk to people in this way. They get the idea, my life can be better. My life can improve. And that is a very compassionate message when people learn that, no matter what the presenting issue.
Well, the reason I hesitate is I'm enjoying everything you're saying. I think that you communicate really well about it. Now, are you pretty much a Bill Glass's heir apparent? Is that an embarrassing question? Is that going to cause you trouble?
Well, I would like to think so, but I say that with a great deal of hesitancy, because there really isn't anyone who can take his place. And I think that for anyone to wear that mantle would be a little presumptuous. And so he does have an organization. There is an international organization. We've taught this around the world. We have a conference where last year people came from every continent except Antarctica. And there is a board, an international board, and I must say, nobody publishes like I do. Nobody writes like I do. I write chapters and books and 13 books. So that gives me some credibility, but I would not want to say that I could ever, measure. I wouldn't even measure myself by his standard, because I think he's a giant.
Now, can someone get in touch and find a way to get training?
Oh, yeah.
In reality therapy?
That's right. Check that website, and they're welcome to contact me on realitytherapywoob.com or to call me in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Give you a number if you like.
Okay, I'd like to do that. It's 513-561-1911. 513-561-1911. But they're welcome to call me, and I can steer them in the right direction. Either my wife will answer or I'll answer. And
there are training programs where you can get certified.
Oh, yes, there is a training program. It's 18 months beginning to end. And one of the things about Glasser, he's always made his training program accessible to people. You don't have to quit your job and move to, Nome, Alaska. This is something that can be done on site at your workplace, and you come to training seminars and then get some practice and supervision between those seminars. But it is accessible, and it normally takes 18 months from beginning to end for the person to really learn it and integrate the ideas. So, but that is available, and I do two major such workshops a year here in Cincinnati, one in February and one in July. So, plus other things that are sometimes on-site, in-house kinds of things, but these are public workshops.
Are those separate than the certification, the 18-month certification?
Are they what?
Are they separate from the 18-month?
No. They're part of that. They're part of that process. Many people don't want to go all the way through certification. They just want a couple of days of exposure and practice the skills. So we don't put any pressure on people to go on. But quite a number do want to go on to get the certification, get the credential. And we give continuing education units and so on.
We're going to be finishing in a few minutes. What do you think is happening in the mental health field right now? Do you see hope in the therapy areas? In psychiatry, I think it's hopeless, just as Bill found, that as soon as you present something which threatens the extremely narrow, authoritarian, controlling, drug and shock-oriented thinking of the psychiatry organization, that the members don't come to hear anything.
Well, this is hard to say. As long as there's people like you around, I think there's hope. And at the same time, I'm concerned about everybody wants to prescribe medication. There's a big move in the psychological world for the right to prescribe medication. In fact, psychologists can do that in several places. I think New Mexico and Louisiana and Guam.
Everybody wants power and control and income.
And
authority of it.
It's very tempting, to see somebody for 15 minutes and see three or four an hour as opposed to one an hour. It's very tempting, and so that's kind of a limitation that we have. But I think there'll always be talk therapy. At least I've gotten that assurance from a number of people. But it's easy to say that when you can't see three or four people in an hour, and pass out medications. So we'll just see what happens in the future. But it could go either way. That's what the concern is.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, of course, for you, it's going to be interesting and exciting to see if you all can keep growing in the absence of Bill.
That's right. That's right. That's why the structure of the organization is so important. And we'll see whether it goes, and I think it will. I mean, I told at a conference, I said, as long as I can put one foot in front of another, from my point of view, there'll be a certification program. And, you know, my plan is to live to be 100, so we'll see how that works out.
You know, I'm thinking the same way.
Are you?
Oh, yeah. I got a lot to do.
Yeah,
I'm working on what I think is one of my most interesting books, and I'm doing as much media and talking with folks pretty much as ever or more. So I'm hoping, I'm thinking 100.
Yeah. What's your next book? What were your next book?
No, it's too much in the planning stages now.
Oh.
I finished it, but I'm just starting to look around for publishers.
Yeah. Yeah.
My most recent book, which I hope maybe could fit in with some of your training programs, is Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. And the subtitle is that it's a guide for prescribers, therapists, patients, and their families.
Mm-hmm.
It's my attempt to empower therapists to take more charge of the drug situation in terms of learning how bad the drugs are, feeling freer and more empowered to talk with patients and families, and to go to the prescribers and say, listen, this is the direction we want to go in. I'm trying to empower therapists to stop doing medication compliance.
Yeah.
And so it might fit well with what you're doing. What's your newest book, Bob?
Well, mine was a part of a series published by American Psychological Association. It's 160 pages. Took me 2 years to write it. It's called Reality Therapy: Theories of Psychotherapy. And I was asked to write the book on reality therapy, just published a year or two ago.
Well, it's nice that the APA, the American Psychological Association, which also wants psychologists to give drugs, is willing and encouraging the publication of a book by you. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I consider it quite an accomplishment. But
any parting words, Bob? We're coming near the end.
Okay. Well, I just wish all of your listeners good mental health, and every day set yourself up for some success.
Thank you, Robert E. Wubling, W-U-E-B-O-L-D-I-N-G.
Thank you, Dr. Bregan.
Thank you, Bob, for being here.
Okay.